Well, I decided to change what we'll consider this morning. I want to talk about the story of a small band of the righteous, surrounded by thousands, yelling derision against them, huddled together, believing in one another and their purpose, against impossible opposition. facing giants, yet hope. No, that's actually not. Gideon, say all those Bible stories, it's the same. Actually, we are going to talk about similar themes, just a little better content to the theme. But I do want to thank a lot of you called and sent emails and stuff to me last night. And just, there's enough new people here that I should probably explain. I have been afflicted with Stanford fandom for just ever. And so, you know, that's usually a cause for suffering, but it was great to hear from a lot of friends that were sort of rejoicing with me in events of last night. So thanks. Preachers sometimes find themselves at a worship-inspired impasse, a new awareness of God and a corresponding struggle with words. That was the case for the author of Hebrews. I'd like to ask you to turn to verse 32 of Hebrews 11. We've been working our way through this chapter with its stories of the faith of Old Testament saints. And in verse 32, we realize the preacher has almost been caught up in something that he's struggling to speak well of. Verse 32. What more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell. I don't know what words to use. The theme is expanded. The panorama is too grand. Time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets. By faith, they conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. From weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. This record is here written to inspire us. We are supposed to recognize that as these phrases are heaped one upon the other, each grander than the last, each more remarkable in its testimony of the power and purpose of God, that we should find ourselves caught and inspired and ask questions. Do we expect to challenge wickedness and overturn injustice? Do we expect to alleviate suffering, to speak truth and power and bring glory to God? Do we recognize that the same God who did such things in generation after generation in the past is still the same God? And that we might be His instrument to bring about a good thing, to tear down a stronghold, to shut the mouths of lions, to quench fire. I hope by the end of our time together this morning, we'll be able to ask those kinds of questions of ourselves. Have we withdrawn from a God who does such things? Or are we willing to let Him put us in a place where grand outcomes might happen? The list continues, though, in the middle of verse 35, and I want to read to you the next part of it, with more tales of courage, a further record of faithfulness to God and honor brought to God, but the list is very different in its tone. Instead of being about good outcomes, this is about hard and sorrowful and difficult outcomes, and yet filled with honor to the Lord and delight, God's delight taken in these as well. Let me read beginning of the verse, middle of verse 35. Others were tortured, not accepting their release so they might obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings. Yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. Those of whom this world is not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. We're going to take 2 weeks combining these lists. The first of the two this week, today, I want to talk about what God does when He brings transformation and uses His servants to do good, bring change, pull down strongholds, and so on. Next week, we're going to reflect more about the outcomes being hard, in which we would prefer them to be otherwise, and yet God calls us into difficulty for His name's sake. So those are this list breaks in half, and we'll consider it in two different weeks. But what I hope will happen today is that we will ask ourselves whether our lives in God's hands might do something we have not even considered yet. This text is a call away from complacency and half-heartedness, a challenge that people like us might from weakness be made strong and engage the fight for the Lord's sake. Well, I want to tell you one of these stories. So might be Gideon, Barak, Samson. It might be one of those who are alluded to. Certainly, for instance, Daniel is the allusion in the stopping the mouth of a lion and so on. We can probably pick out some of these allusions. Obviously, we have some named. It could have been any of those stories, but I actually want to step backwards two verses. Because last week I said we would talk about Rahab, and I wasn't able to do that last week. And so I was thinking and examining and considering which one of these stories we might pull out to challenge ourselves before we move on to the next section. And I've been more and more taken with the story of Rahab that we had to skip over last week. I think what we find in that text, and I commend it to your study, is inspiring, it's challenging, it's filled with the presence of Christ. So I want to go back and have us consider this one story for our to be challenged by it. Verse 30 of Hebrews 11. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith Rahab the prostitute did not perish along with those who were disobedient, for she had welcomed the spies in peace. Well, the time in Israel's history when this takes place is after the Exodus, of course. You go back to Hebrews 11, it begins with creation and sort of tells the story roughly in chronological order. The story of the first believers, the story of the patriarchs, the story of the sojourn in Egypt, eventually slavery in Egypt, eventually Exodus and release from Egypt and so on. We sort of are catching these things as they happen. And in these verses, 30 and 31, the nation of Israel is now at the end of its wilderness wanderings. They had been released from slavery. They went into the wilderness. They might have entered the land after 1 year. They refused to trust God and spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness when a generation died. And now finally they are at the verge on the shore of the Jordan River, about to go home to the land given to their forefathers, from which they'd been removed for all these decades and centuries. They're about to go home. And as they are on the edge of the Jordan, Joshua sends in some spies to cross into the land to see the strongholds, to see what difficulties remain, to see what obstacles are there. And the spies go into Jericho. Prior to entering the Promised Land, spies were sent on a reconnaissance mission. Rahab welcomed them, hid them, helped them escape, and asked that her family be spared when Fortress Jericho fell, as she knew it would. The people in Jericho and throughout Canaan had heard the story of the Exodus. They'd heard the story of the Red Sea parted. They'd heard the story of the faithfulness of God and the power of God and the coming home of His people. And most all who heard it resisted what they heard. Even in Jericho, they pulled back in fear. We'll find out. Rahab's words will tell us that they were afraid. But in fear, they pulled back into their strongholds and strengthened it and resisted. And their fear led them to resist God. But Rahab, alone among them, believed that God was good and He was doing a good thing, that He was carrying out purposes that were ultimately worthy, and that she should submit to what God was doing. And she told the spies, here are her words as she spoke to them in Jericho. We heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. And listen to this word of testimony. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Having heard of the events of the Exodus, her heart was filled with faith. This must mean that He is the one true God. This must mean He is Lord of above and below, that He is the master of history, that I should submit to Him rather than resist Him. That I should acknowledge Him rather than hate Him. And so her life was a life of faith, and she was waiting for the opportunity to express the faith. When will the people come? She not only declared her faith, but she risked herself to save lives and to submit to the plan of God that would unfold. So here's that's who Rahab is. I want to think with you a little bit about what we kind of know from her story. About just kind of re-examine what the evidence we find in Joshua and the few references that are made in the New Testament. What does Rahab's story tell us? Well, here's the first observation. When you read the places where Rahab is mentioned in the Bible, there is over-repeated, I would suggest to you, references to her profession. The author of Joshua says the first time her name is mentioned that she is the prostitute named Rahab. That's in chapter 2 of Joshua. At the end of the telling of the Rahab story, in chapter 6 of Joshua, she is called Rahab the prostitute. The references in Joshua's mouth and the mouth of the spies as they enter the land and tell the story of what will happen to them there are the stories, they repeatedly reference her as Rahab the prostitute. And once Joshua even says of her, she is just the prostitute and doesn't even use her name. In the New Testament, there are three places where she's mentioned. One is this one in Hebrews. The writer of Hebrews calls her Rahab the prostitute. One is in James, the book of James. James calls her Rahab the prostitute. In only one other place, in Matthew, in the genealogy of Jesus, is she mentioned without reference to her profession. And we'll come back to that. There must be some reason that someone who, in so short a span, with only actually five chapters of the Bible that reference her, chapter 2 and 6 of Joshua, Hebrews, James, and Matthew, we find so often our attention called to her background and her profession. Prostitution can be different things in different cultures. This city, the events of Jericho and so on, were well over 3,000 years ago in history. We don't know exactly the conditions attained. We don't know what it was like precisely. We know that in certain places, different dynamics occur. But in all of them, it is a hard life. In every case, the world that she lived in and the experiences she would have had, from what we know, would have been, we can be certain, were extremely difficult. Greed and lust combine. Bodies are commodities. Human connections are hurtful, and hard hearts become a survival mechanism. She lived this life and she would have had every right to be angry with human beings and with the God who had arranged for her life to be what it was. But she was not. The spies that came into the land ended up in her home, in her house, and were protected by her there and sent away. She was receptive to what happened. She was not hardened and angry, although she had the right to be. She had a difficult life. Second thing I would note about the story, and again, if you go back to read the chapters 2 and 6 of Joshua, you'll find repeated references to her family. She asked for one gift. The spies came into the land. She hid them, protected them, sent them away so they weren't killed. And she said, will you give me a gift as a result of what I've done? And her gift is, will you save my family? She never asks to be saved herself. She never asks, will you please take care of me in the future? What she does is she asks that her family be protected. And how she references her family, and again, it's repeated as others tell her story or report back to Joshua, or Joshua speaks of it to his army or whatever, is her family consists of her father and her brothers, as well as mother and sisters. Her father and her brother are mentioned over and over again in this text as we hear her story. Now, this culture was, as the Middle East is today, a culture that's dominated by tribal history, patriarchal tribal history. The people of this place would have lived in environments where men had the power and therefore the responsibility to take care of the women in their tribe, in their city, in their group. She is in the role of taking care of her father and her brothers. She is their savior. She is the one that pleads on their behalf rather than they on hers. She has no husband in Jericho. She will later. She has no son. And she is defending the man who ought to have defended her. How is it that she ended up in this life fighting for her own survival, taking care of them? Where was her father? Where were her brothers? And the text doesn't examine that. It just gives us enough information for us to ask the question. A hard life and a life in which there must at least have been disappointment, if not worse, in the experience of her family. We might finally note when we read Rahab's story, as many do, that you could be angry about what the story of the text tells us. You could be angry about circumstances like this. Some have found themselves saying, here's another example of the inevitable tyranny of patriarchal religion. Another example of how people are terrible to each other, men are terrible to women, and when you add religion in, you make it worse. And this is another story of tragedy and awfulness and the despicability of religion. But if you stay tuned and you listen long enough, you realize it is exactly the opposite of that. The Bible does not, in the final analysis, make that point. It makes the opposite point. This is a story of grace. The end of the Rahab part of Joshua 6, it says that she and her family were joined to the children of Israel. They become part of the nation and its future. That's all it says. But if you're willing to listen carefully and examine a bit and wonder at what God's up to and why he does what he does, you'll find yourself looking at genealogies. And you realize what happened to Rahab when she joined the people of God. What happened is she married a man named Salmon. And so she had a husband in the end of the day. God gave her a husband. And she had a son, at least one son, one that we know of, a man named Boaz. And the story of Boaz in the book of Ruth is one of the most remarkable and wonderful and beautiful stories in the Bible. He is heroic for a number of reasons. He stands out for a number of reasons. In the darkest period of Israel's history, the time of the judges, there stands Boaz. And his primary greatness is his care for women. Poor women. Outsiders. Those in need. He married Ruth. He cared for Naomi. He had instincts that were unusual in his time and place, maybe because his mother was who she was, and she taught him to see the world with that heart and that willingness. But Boaz is outstanding for a number of reasons, particularly his care for women. Further, Boaz is the great-grandfather of David. Boaz's son and his son finally bore David, the royal line, Israel's great king, the king who would be father ultimately to Messiah, who will rule forever. The royal line of Israel, which is the royal line of the world, is Rahab's line. And I mentioned to you that we see her name given to us in the genealogy in the first chapter of Matthew. It's the genealogy of Jesus. It's the Messiah's genealogy. And she is named precisely, few women are named there, she is one of them, but she is not Rahab the harlot. She is Rahab alone, Rahab the foremother of Christ. And in the long run, Rahab's story is a story of grace. It's the story of God changing the world. A stronghold was torn down in Jericho and so on and so forth. There were good outcomes in the near term, extraordinary outcomes in the long term. Every generation should be able to tell of the work of God among us. We ought to have stories of what he's doing and people we know, people like us who step into opportunities, who see open doors and go through them, who take risks, who find the delight of God in our choosing the obedience that He makes available to us. God didn't choose the best and the brightest, ever. He didn't choose people who were all stars, who were destined for greatness and couldn't help it. Whether it's Barak, whether it's Gideon, Barak, Jephthah, on that group, or whether it's Rahab in Jericho. Only in God's eyes was the Canaanite prostitute a candidate to change the world. Only He could see and do such a thing. Where are our stories? What is He doing now? We're ordinary people. We're people that few would tab for greatness. And so we ask, but maybe we'll be the one. Maybe we'll say a word that changes a course. Maybe we'll act in ways that are surprising. What more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who conquered kingdoms by faith, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword from weakness, were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight, women received back their dead by resurrection. Do we miss open doors because we're too dazzled by 30-year-old multi-billionaires or entertained into a stupor? Does the tyranny of the urgent drown out God's voice in our experience? Are we so aware of our inadequacies that risk seems impossible? Well, I want to go back to Rahab's story now and pull out what I would say are four lessons for us to think with, for us to question ourselves with, for us to pray about, for us to ask God's help with. Four things. First of all, Rahab believed the information about God that she had. When the Exodus occurred, the Egyptian armies hated what they were seeing, that God had parted the sea, that He was rescuing His people, and so they charged into the midst of the sea and were drowned. They saw the miracle. They saw the parted sea, and it hardened their hearts to resistance, and they were destroyed. The children of Israel went through the sea, but they did not trust God as a result. Their hearts were hardened and a generation of them died in the wilderness. They saw the miracle of the Exodus, but it didn't lead them to faith. Those in Jericho heard the story of the Exodus. They were frightened by the story of their Exodus. It says their hearts melted, but it inclined them to resistance, to pull back behind their walls, to strengthen their walls, to resist God. Rahab heard the story of the Exodus, of the miracle, of the love of God for His people, of His commitment, of His bringing in a future. She heard all the same data that everybody else had, and yet it changed her. She assumed this was a God to be worshipped and bowed before, rather than to be hardened against. And so when the day came that she had an opportunity to act on it, she was ready to act. She had believed what she knew, and therefore was prepared for the moment when she would be called on to act on what she believed. That opportunity is ours too. We have the Scriptures. We have a great deal more data than she had. We have truth about God that we can hear and believe and listen to and revel in and be changed by, so that when we are called to speak up, when we're called to be generous in ways that are difficult, when we're called to fight for the downtrodden, when we're called to whatever we're called to, we're ready to do so because we have the habit of believing what God has already said. It's difficult when the crisis comes. You start to realize, I'm in a crisis now. I better thumb through the Bible and find something to believe. God may answer that prayer as well, but He is much more likely to strengthen us as we believe every day the things He tells us are changed every day by every new bit of information, so that when the time comes, we're ready. That was true of Rahab. Second of the four things, she didn't let her hard life strip her of hope or harden her from God's hand extended. She had a hard life. We don't know how much of it she chose. I think by inference we could suggest she had a hard life and a lot of other people contributed to making her life hard. But she never believed that she was the person who her circumstances might have defined her to be. She never believed it. She didn't let the hard, difficult, sordid world she lived in define her. She believed things about God that she knew, and she hoped that it would be different. And she didn't let the hard world ruin her. Worship elevates our status. When we worship God freely and from the heart and with other people, we are saying we belong to Him. How can we be the weak and the ruined person that our circumstances might tell us to be if we enter freely into the presence of the living God in worship? We can't be. And as we worship, we redefine ourselves and believe better things about ourselves. Thirdly, she took action. When the opportunity came, she stepped forward. James highlights that. That's one of the things that he's particularly impressed with, that she didn't just talk a good game, she acted on the opportunity. Most of us get so used to procrastination that when the day comes, when the Lord says to us, step into the mess, speak a word of kindness, take a risk for Jesus' sake, get out of your comfort zone, deal with the rut. We're so used to procrastination and not ever doing anything that we can't respond. Or we're so used to the five-year plan, the big goals, the step one, step two, step three, I'm going here and I know exactly what everything's going to consist of for every day of every week of every year of the rest of my life. How can anything different happen? But she was ready. And when it was clear to her that it was her chance to participate in something great, she did it. The last thing I would say, the fourth thing I would say about her story is it teaches us a great lesson. She committed herself to the salvation of someone else, and God saved her. She never said to the spies, "Please remember me when you come back." She said, "Save my family." And God heard her say that, and He rescued her, along with her family. And the surest way, I think, to find ourselves in the comforting arms of God is to be less concerned about ourselves than we are about someone else. To want the best for other people so that God can give the best to us. I want to end with just a little bit of quiet, a moment of quiet, for us to ask questions about whether God still does great things. Does He still quench fires? Does He still tear down strongholds? Does He still turn back wickedness? Does He still take up instruments of people like us to make a difference in the world? Are we inclined to participate? Or are we? If a door opened in front of us, would we walk through it? Let's take a moment to ask those things in prayer, and then the worship team will come forward and lead us in worship.